It's going to be a great shame to, since this looks about 100 times better than my what I write on the blackboard. It's a shame to erase it. But okay, so I was just going to pick up where we left off in the previous lecture, and then by the end of this hour, you will know everything you need to know ever about differential geometry and general relativity, and then you can just move on with your life and learn other things. So, in short, in the previous lecture, we had introduced manifolds. We had said you could have, you know, tensors living on those manifolds. We had said basically the point of a tensor, as far as we're going to introduce it, is that when you put different coordinate systems on the manifold, that the components of the tensor transform in a specific way. And at the end of the day, for example, when we're doing general relativity, we're mostly going the one of the key physical ideas in general relativity is that all of the sort of physical equations that we're going to write down are going to be equations relating one tensor to another, so that since both sides have, assuming both sides have the same indices and are both tensors, they will both transform the same way under coordinate transformations. And so, in other words, the result will be true independent of the coordinate system which we lay down on the manifold. The coordinate system is just a convenient thing. It's not, you know, it's a matter of convenience, a matter of choice. It's not physical. The idea of general relativity is that it's the tensors that are equal to one another. Those are the physical things. Okay, so then we introduced a bit of structure on our manifold, the connection, which had components alpha, beta, gamma, and we were in the middle of discussing the various things that gives us. So one thing we said is that it allows us to replace the ordinary derivative, the ordinary partial derivative, by a covariant derivative, so that if we act with the covariant derivative on some tensor, the resulting object is also a tensor with one more lower index. we also said that we now have a notion of parallel transport on the manifold. So if I have if I give you two different points on the manifold and a path connecting them, you can now tell me whether a tensor at this point is parallel or not to a tensor at this point. You can carry it by carrying it along the path. So now the next basic point that I want to make is that a key point is that you need to not only give me the two points, but also a particular path to do my parallel transport along, because the parallel transport will be different in general for different paths. So if I pick another path here, so if I start with a tensor over here, t mu nu, and I parallel transport it along this path, I'll get a different answer here. I'll get a different tensor at this point than if I parallel transported it along this path. That isn't the case in a flat space, but that will, in general, be the case in a space that is curved. And so this leads us to, so this is the next point that I want to make, is that once you've introduced a connection, but before you've introduced the metric, so we don't yet have we don't have any notion of g mu nu on this manifold yet. We already have the notion of curvature, because what curvature is, one way to introduce curvature, it is a measure of this failure of two different parallel transport to agree along two different paths. If you think about the infinitesimal version of that statement, you will find that it is let me say it a different way. I am going to introduce, and if you think it through, this is very closely related to what I just said. I'm going to introduce the Riemann curvature tensor, which is this four-index curvature tensor. I'm going to define it by saying, by the so-called Ricci identity. So the Ricci identity is this. If I take So now if I have a vector field, so a vector at every point on my at every point x on my manifold, and I take I first differentiate that field with respect to delta, and then with respect to gamma, and then I subtract the differentiation in the opposite order. So I take the commutator of the of these two two covariant derivatives. First delta, then gamma, and then minus first gamma, then delta. So if these were partial derivatives, that commutator would vanish. The partial the commutator of two partial derivatives acting on a function. Again, another fact that you learned in multivariable calculus is that the commutator of two partial derivatives acting on essentially anything is zero. Okay, so these guys commute, but covariant derivatives do not commute when acting on a tensor. And the measure of that lack of commutativity is going to be the definition of the Riemann curvature tensor. That's the measure of how much curvature there is in the spacetime. And so let's just but from this formula we're going to get the basic formula for what R is, what the Riemann curvature tensor is in terms of the connection. So let me just briefly sketch how that's going to go. So we just want to basically expand out the covariant derivatives on the left-hand side here. So let me just, for the sake of clarity, just add parentheses for a minute. Okay. So now this covariant derivative acting on this tensor, this is a tensor with two indices, one lower and one upper. So when I act with this covariant derivative, I'm going to get a partial derivative term times the thing in brackets, and then, let me just write the thing in brackets. A plus term coming from this index, and then a minus term coming from this index. What did I do wrong? Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Ignore the mess currently taking place. Did I do that right? No? Yes? Where did that alpha come from? Oh, yeah. That's just, I made that up. Okay, sorry. I'm making a hash of this already. Only like 1 minute into the lecture. Okay, so I've expanded out this partial derivative correctly now. Yes. Okay, and then I would do the same thing here. Okay, minus three terms, analogous to this guy. And then I will expand out the inner partial derivative. I mean the inner covariant derivative. So this guy will become. And so forth. Okay, so that's I expand that one, and every term I have another covariant derivative to expand. And so then what will happen? What will happen when you go through the algebra is that so there are going to be terms with two partial derivatives. And so there are going to be terms where two of those partial derivatives both act. Basically, what you're going to find is that every term that you get from over here, in which either one or two partial derivatives acts on a V, is canceled by a corresponding term from over here. There's always a corresponding term with the opposite side sign. So at the end of the day, all those terms cancel. And you're only left with terms with no derivatives acting on V. Okay, so let's collect all of those terms and rename the indices as necessary so that the name of the index on V is beta. Then what you'll see is that what's left here is just four terms. The first two terms look like a gamma and then a partial derivative. And then the second two, there's plus a term like this, and there's minus a term like this. And then there are two more terms that look like just the product of two gammas. And again, there's a plus. There's one term that comes with a plus sign and one term that comes with a minus sign. Okay, so that, again, I encourage you to check, and I'm not going to. It's really not very long to check, but it's long enough that you won't like it if I do it on board. So let me just tell you the answer so that we can look at it for a minute here. Some of these things, like somehow, nobody means to be a bad person, and nobody means to memorize expressions with a lot of indices. But some of these things are so just come up so frequently that you end up just remembering them. So this is an example of a formula that I never wanted to know a formula like this, but nevertheless, I can tell you from experience that whether you like it or not, you just kind of will learn this formula. And it's kind of helpful. Well, oh, it's kind of helpful. So maybe I'll just say a word about how to remember the formula. I mean, or stated another way, you'll find that even though you originally didn't want to know the formula, that then when you don't know it, it's going to be annoying because you keep having to look it up, and different books have it written in different ways. Everyone, you find your own favorite way to remember this formula, or don't remember it if you can manage it. I don't. It's up to you guys. So anyway, at least once in your life, you should check that this basic line of reasoning leads to this formula. And so the basic point that I again want to stress is that we now have a formula for the complete curvature tensor that is completely specified once you've specified the connection. You didn't need to give me the metric. Okay, the metric doesn't appear anywhere in this formula. It's just this connection gamma, the components of the connection, and partial derivatives of them. Another thing that you could in principle check, although you don't, I would say this is in the, you have to choose your battles. You could in principle check that we worked out before what is the transformation law for gamma under a coordinate transformation, and it did not transform like a tensor. You could check that if you apply that transformation law to all of these gammas, that all of the non-tensorial parts cancel, and R does transform like a tensor. Okay, so R is a tensor, but don't check that. Just take my word for that. In any case, this is not the best way to go about checking that. There are some of these formulas, there are better ways to understand them where you don't have to go through as much gore to see that something is a tensor. And so anyway, don't check that. And I don't know why I erased it. Let me put it back. Sorry about that. I'm actually going to need that in a second, so I apologize. What? Yeah, that would be a great help. I'm not sure I've used it for good and rather than evil so far. Okay. So now the reason I'm writing this back up is to say. So this four index object is the Riemann curvature tensor, named after one of my favorite people of all time, although not for this so much. But this is an awesome thing, too. But this guy, Riemann, great guy. Great, he's very great. Anyway. But then there is also, again, before introducing the metric, we can now define the Ricci curvature tensor. Ricci, that guy. No, I'm just joking. But anyway. So Ricci, we don't need the metric. We just have to we, we just to get the Ricci tensor, that's just a piece. It turns out that this guy has even though it looks like it has a lot of indices, it has a bunch of symmetries that are okay. These are summarized in my notes, but so like for example, if you switch gamma and delta here, that's not really a new component. That's always that just brings an overall minus sign. So and same with anyway, they're summarized in my notes. But so this guy has 20 components, and this to get from the Ricci to get from the Riemann tensor to the Ricci tensor, we set alpha equal to the third index here, gamma, and sum over the repeated indices, and that's this guy. So this is now a you can check that this thing is a symmetric tensor. So a symmetric tensor, you know, a symmetric matrix with a 4x4 symmetric matrix has, you know, 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 equals 10 components. And then since by symmetry, these guys are then all determined. So it has, so this guy has only 10 independent components. So we've sort of thrown away half the information in the Riemann tensor when contracting it down to get the Ricci tensor. Okay, but this guy we will need. This is nevertheless important, and we will need it for defining the Einstein equations. I should say the other 10 components are in another tensor. You can sort of set this tensor cleanly separates into two pieces. This Ricci tensor, which has 10 of the components, and then the other 10 components are in the Weyl tensor. But the Weyl tensor is a tensor that has exactly the same four-index structure and the same symmetries as the Ricci tensor, but if you trace any two components, so for example, if we did this thing where if you took the Weyl tensor here and you set alpha equal to gamma and then sum, the answer would be zero. So it all traces of two indices on the Weyl tensor vanish. But anyway, I decided to omit the Weyl tensor in this brief survey. So let me see. Is there anything else to say? So no. So now I think that's more or less. So that's roughly speaking as far as we get with the connection by itself. So now, what else do we get by introducing a metric on the manifold? So, we put a metric on the manifold. So at every point, there is this tensor with two lower indices. So one of the things we can now do is if we have two vectors sitting at this point. X, we can take their inner product. So their dot product basically. And in particular, you can take the dot product of a vector with itself, and then the square root of that thing is what you might call This thing is the squared magnitude of that vector. So vectors now have a magnitude associated with them. You can take dot products. You can do kind of a lot of the usual things that you're used to doing with vectors you can do those things that I just said. A thing that we alluded to earlier is that up till now we were sort of more or less choosing the connection to be whatever, more or less whatever we wanted. But now, once you have a metric, you don't want to choose the connection independently. There is a single connection there is a unique connection specified by the metric that makes sense, that is compatible with the metric in various ways. And so let me say that one way to say that is there is a unique connection such that the covariant derivative, every component of the covariant derivative of every component of the metric vanishes everywhere. Okay? So there are various ways to say what this means. One way is to say that if you parallel transported the metric around, so the metric is covariantly constant with respect to the connection. If you parallel transported it around on the manifold via any curve, you would find that it is parallel transported into itself, right? In other words, so we have two points here, and at the beginning, this guy has value g mu at point x at x1, and this guy has g mu nu at x2. But then I can take any curve that I want and parallel transport this guy along that curve over here, and the result of parallel transporting it will be equal to the metric that was already sitting at that point. Okay, so somehow the metric is everywhere parallel with respect to the connection. And so a related point is that parallel transport of any tensor becomes consistent. This is actually something that I think is one of the this is one of the problems on the tutorial. There are various meanings that can be given to this equation. So what I want to say here is if you now consider the combination if you want to derive the connection that results from this guy, and this is again something that's suggested in the notes that is worth checking. So if this thing is zero everywhere, then this sum of such terms is zero. So now if you just expand out these covariant derivatives, so these are covariant derivatives. Remember, my semicolon means covariant derivative. If you expand that thing out, you will find that what this equation is saying is g alpha delta you will find that it is nothing but a formula for the connection, which is 1 half g alpha delta. This is another one of these things where I just remember it. You probably will too if you do enough general relativity. Okay, so again, the structure is this. This upper index appears here. There's another dummy index that in the first two terms that come with a plus sign, the dummy index appears as one of the indices on G. In the third term that comes with a minus sign, the dummy index it's the component of the derivative that is being taken. And then the rest of the expression is just symmetrized with respect to beta and gamma. So there's a beta and gamma here, and then they're swapped here, and then G is symmetric. So that. Okay. So this thing, this connection, this special connection that is compatible with the metric is called the Levi-Civita connection. And so this is the connection that you're interested in general relativity, almost always. Okay. So another thing that the metric gives you is it also defines the distance between nearby points. So if you have a point on the manifold with coordinate x, mu, that's too small. If you have a point with coordinate x mu, and the metric there is g mu nu of x, then the metric tells you it defines an invariant distance to infinitesimally neighboring points. So if you have another nearby point with coordinate x mu plus dx mu, the invariant distance between those two guys, that looks like a little smiley face, it is called ds. And ds squared is given by, in other words, we said that now you can define an inner product of a vector with itself. You can define the norm of a vector, or the squared magnitude of a vector. And so the distance from a point with coordinate x to a point with coordinates x plus dx is the square of that distance is the squared norm of that little vector dx. Yeah. And that means that we can now finally define the length of a curve. The length of a curve between two points on the manifold has now a meaning that is independent of coordinates. It's just the integral from p to q of dx. Or in other words, you see what I mean. So it's equal to the integral of the square root of this thing in whatever coordinates you choose. So you know what I mean. You're adding, you divide this thing into tiny little segments. Each has a little ds defined by the metric at that point. You add those up, and that's the length of the curve. But now, once we've done that, it turns out that geodesics have a second special property. We had originally defined geodesics by saying that, you know, of all the possible curves connecting points P and Q, that a geodesic was the one, were the ones that, if you took the tangent vector at the beginning and you parallel transported it along, you would find that the parallel transported tangent vector remain tangent to the curve throughout the process of parallel transport. But now that we've introduced the length of the vector, it turns out there is another meaning of a special thing that a geodesic is. It is the special sort of curve that is stationary, whose length is stationary under small variations of the curve. So if this thing were a geodesic and I took a little infinitesimal modification of the curve, in general, I would induce at first order in this modification a change in the length of the curve. But if it's a geodesic, I don't do that. So this is just, so for example, well, maybe there's something else I want to say about that, but I don't want to say it yet. But let me say that point of view, so that sounds a lot like classical mechanics, right? In classical mechanics, you're given the given a curve, we can define the length of that curve. Okay, so if this curve is called gamma, and it has some it's described by some coordinates x mu of some parameter tau along the curve, you give me x mu of tau, and I can compute the length of that path. But now in classical mechanics, if you give me some trajectory through configuration space x mu of t, I can construct the let's call that path gamma. I can construct the action associated with that path, and then the idea of Hamilton's reformulation of classical mechanics, or various mathematicians' reformulation of classical mechanics, is that of all the possible paths that you can follow between two points in configuration space, the actual classical trajectory that a system follows, remember, is the one that makes this action stationary. It's the one, the classical trajectories are the ones that if you you vary them a little bit, their action doesn't change to first order in that variation. And so you probably remember that leads to, so if the action is an integral of some integral of the parameter along the path of some Lagrangian, which depends on the value of the coordinate and its derivative, and maybe also explicitly on the parameter along the path, that the requirement that this thing be equal to zero, that the variation of this thing vanished, that this be stationary on the classical path, is rephrased via the calculus of variations as the Euler-Lagrange equations here, dl dx, dl with respect, the partial derivative of L with respect to the mu x is ddt, the partial derivative of L with respect to the mu component of x dot. So an advantage of another thing that you get once you add the metric to the manifold is that you can reformulate the geodesic equation. You can rederive the geodesic equation in these terms. And so something that I suggest in the notes that you do is just check. So if I start with the metric, okay. And so now, I will obtain the corresponding Lagrangian. This way. So where here a dot means dd tau. It means a derivative with respect to the what is called the affine parameter along the curve. So now if you derive the Euler-Lagrange equations, from this Lagrangian, you can show that those are equivalent to, and this is a quite straightforward and very worth doing exercise. Those are equivalent to the geodesic equation that I wrote the previous way. Okay, so geodesics have these two different meanings. It's very important to keep them in mind, keep both of their meanings in mind. Particles in general relativity, in the absence of other external forces, in the absence of any non-gravitational external forces, test particles move along geodesics of the metric. So the trajectory of a particle will be x mu of tau, which is some geodesic associated with the metric on that manifold, g mu nu. The tangent vector to that curve is called the four velocity of the particle. And then for a massive particle, m times its four velocity is its four momentum. So this is the thing which in those coordinates has components that are basically what you would usually call, in non-relativistic terms, the energy and the three momentum. Yeah. So if you don't have a test particle, this statement only applies to test particles. Yes. So if you have like a big body, if you have like a big black hole or a star moving through a space-time, then if it's big enough that it curves the space-time around it to a significant degree, then it depends on what scale you look at things, but in general, if you try to interpret that thing as a metric plus a particle living on it, it will look like what happens is that the particle, when it is accelerated, generates gravitational waves that move away from the particle, but then momentum is conserved. It gets basically the short story is that's actually an extremely confusing problem that is called the self-force problem. What happens to a non-test particle? Or, for example, what happens to two non-test particles, like two black holes? You cannot just think of, or two spinning black holes or something like this, you cannot just think of as moving through. Yeah, in full geo, the short answer is that the statement that I made only applies to test particles, and in the limit that the particle is small enough that the curvature that it if you look at the particle on a scale that is so zoomed out that the length scale associated with the particle, so let's say the particle has some mass m, if you look, really what I should do is I should answer this after class, but because I'm gonna bumble. But so in units where G, if you take, you can choose units where G is equal to C is equal to 1. In such units, mass and length have the same dimensions. A particle that has a mass m is hardly curving the space-time around it if you look at it at distances much bigger than, if you look at scales much bigger than m, at distances much bigger than m away from that particle. So if you are talking about a single particle moving through such a space-time, and this scale m is also small relative to the any other curvature in the space-time. So for example, in an expanding universe, there is some curvature associated with the expansion of the universe, but the length scale associated with that curvature may be huge relative to the length scale associated with m, the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole. If that m is tiny relative to the other curvature scale, for example, the curvature scale, the cosmological curvature scale, and you want to know what's going on in the space-time on scales that are large relative to m, then to a good approximation you can treat. So for practical purposes, you can figure out, for example, for a single black hole that's moving through the universe, you can think of it as in the conditions that I just described, you can think of it as moving along a geodesic of that background to a very good approximation. But yeah, the more general question of what happens is, the short thing to say about it is that it is a continuing and not settled subject of current research, basically. How to properly think of it as exactly how the geodesic equation is modified for finite bodies that back react on the geometry. I should say that answer goes on and on. If you're interested in more, I can tell you more about it afterwards. But so let me see. What else did I want to say? So the geodesic equation has the second meaning. And another important thing. One other important thing we can do with the metric is, we remember, with a connection we were able to define the Ricci curvature. But now with the metric, we can contract the two indices, alpha and beta, to define the so-called Ricci scalar. At that point, that is my, that completes, I think, roughly speaking, the summary of all the differential geometry that I wanted to summarize before introducing GR itself. And so So in my notes, all of GR is covered in a page and a half. And the way that that is done is, okay, what I mean by introducing GR here for the purposes of this lecture is just to tell you what is the action principle that defines GR. And then I wanted to explain to you the simplest way to go from that action principle to the field equations, the Einstein field equations that govern the evolution of the metric. I end at 12:30. Nevertheless, it could be time for a joke. So you just encouraged me by laughing at the previous one. So Moitia has been downstairs. He went to his downstairs neighbor's apartment, and he's playing poker, and he's out late, and he stumbles back into his apartment late at night. And he's white as a sheet, he's pale, and his wife says, Moitia, what's wrong? And he says, oh, you'll never forgive me. I've gambled away everything. We've lost, I don't know, we'll never be able to repay them. And his wife says, wait here 1 minute. And she opens the window and she says, Betya! And downstairs window opens, and Betya leans her head out the window and goes, what? And she says, your husband will never get your money. And she slams the window, and she says to her husband, let them worry. Anyway, this is the more appropriate reaction to such a joke. Not laughter, but just horror and like, what? I'm not, you know, you have to understand, this is separate from I mean, this stuff is recommended behavior. This is, you know, but that joke, I'm not telling you how to live your life. You understand? I'm just telling you what the joke is. It's not. Okay. Okay, so general relativity is defined by an action principle that looks like this. First, a result that I'm not going to derive for you, but if you think about it, I think you will find makes sense, is that the action, we want that to be a scalar. We want that to be something that is not dependent on what coordinates I take on the space-time. And we write that as an integral over all space-time of some Lagrange density L, which is a scalar. But this function is defined locally on the metric on the manifold. So it, you know, it varies from position to position on the manifold, and then we're integrating that over the whole manifold. But if this thing is a scalar, then the integral just written this way is not a scalar. Because you can see that because another thing you know from multivariable calculus is that when you change coordinates from x to x prime, that this thing does not just become d4 x prime. There's an extra factor here, which is the determinant of the Jacobian of the transformation. Okay, so if this is a Lagrangian, I mean, if this is a scalar that is invariant under coordinate transformation, and this thing is a something that does change under coordinate transformations, the integral will not be invariant under coordinate transformations. So that's bad. So this thing is the solution. That's all I'm going to say about it. This essentially is that Jacobian factor. Anyway, I leave that to your own private thoughts. If that doesn't make sense, or you can ask me about it afterwards. But this thing is the Lagrangian density. This thing in curly brackets. And so it has two pieces. Oh, so you're, there's a separate thing called a tensor density. Yes, yeah, so you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I shouldn't use that. Okay, so call the Lagrangian? Okay, let's call it the Lagrangian. Good. That's good. I meant, yeah. You know, sometimes you call this thing the Lagrangian. And then, you know, if you're now going to take the Lagrangian per unit volume, you would call that but you're right that there is a separate notion of what a distinction between a tensor and a tensor density, and that's not what I meant. So L sub M, that's the matter part of the Lagrangian. So that's where all of the matter fields in the theory, besides the metric tensor, are all over here. So if there's a Higgs scalar field out there, you know, it will appear over here. There's a spinner field corresponding to the electron. It's over here. The only thing that this depends on. So this here, 16 pi g, that's g Newton, that's Newton's constant, that's just a constant. This is lambda, that's the cosmological constant, that's also a constant. This is R, the Ricci scalar, the thing that we just defined, which depends on both, which you can think of it as either depending on just the metric. I mean, because if you think of our formula for the connection, so we said R was the inverse metric. Uh-oh, I forgot to say what the inverse metric is. So this, when I write G with upper indices, that is just defined to be the 2 by 2 matrix that is the inverse of this 2x2 matrix. And so when I say it's the inverse, I mean that when you multiply those two matrices together, you should get the identity matrix, which in this notation is the delta, the which is this, which is the thing, which is the tensor, which is 1 whenever alpha and gamma are equal to each other, and 0 whenever they're not equal to each other. And so I also probably should have mentioned that, so with these two guys together, with the metric and the inverse, another important thing that we get with them is the ability to raise and lower indices on tensors. So for example, if we start with contravariant vector and we contract that alpha index with an index on the metric, leaving a hanging beta index, this thing is now, you can check that this thing transforms as a covariant tensor, as a covariant vector. And so we just notationally speaking, we just write it as having lowered the index on the same object. It's really the same object. We've just changed a changed an index this is like a vector and this is like a dual vector, and they're the same object. So this is the dual vector that is dual to this vector. And similarly, if you start with a tensor with a lower index and contract it with the inverse metric, that raises its index. Okay, and while we're at it, another thing that I think I forgot to ever mention is, although it sounds like people have seen this before, is that, you know, if you have tensors, there is this Einstein summation convention that whenever you have two repeated indices with one up and one down, implicitly what we mean by this expression is that you're supposed to sum this over all values of delta. But the Einstein summation convention is just to not write the sum there. Just whenever you see an upper and a lower index that are the same in a pair, you're supposed to know that you're supposed to that you sum over those. And the reason is that when you sum over them, you can check that when you contract any two indices like that between on the same tensor or between the product of two tensors, the resulting thing is also transforms like a tensor as if you just got rid of those indices. So this thing is some other tensor with these indices, and the delta is just gone. Okay? Okay. So, sorry about that. So, now, in the final 10 minutes, I just want to briefly explain to you that. So, I give you an action. What are you supposed to do with it? There's really only one thing to do with an action, especially before we're dealing with quantum mechanics, and that is you vary it and you demand that the variation be stationary with respect to anything that you can think of. So, for example, here, well, what does this action depend on? It depends on the metric g mu nu, and then it depends on all the matter fields contained in here. So, you're a physicist. Your main job in life is someone presents you with an action like this, and you go through and you begin varying it. You vary the action with respect to you add a little variation of the metric. You see what variation that induces in the action. You set that to zero, that is one of the equations of motion. That is in particular the equation of motion, the classical equation of motion governing the metric. That thing is called the Einstein equation. And then you can also take this action and you can vary one of the matter fields. You vary some other matter field. You see what variation that induces in the action to first order. You set it equal to zero. And you go through, you do that for every field you can think of, every field that on which the action depends, and you get all of the classical equations of motion governing the dynamics of that system. Now, the one that we are interested in at the moment is this variation of the metric, which leads to the Einstein equations. These are the basic equations of general relativity, the classical equations of motion for the metric itself. And the main point that I want to make is that, so we saw that there was this formula for gamma. We derived this formula So you can think of gamma as being a function of g, and then we had this formula which I won't fully reproduce, but we had this formula for r in terms of gamma. So you can think of r as being a function of g, and then the Ricci scalar, which appears here, is just the contraction of the Ricci tensor with the inverse metric. So that's just a function of g. So in principle, one way of going about deriving the Einstein equations is to take that huge monstrosity of a function of g and vary it in the way that you would vary any other action. But I'm telling you, that's not the way to go. That turns out to be a mess, and there's a better way. And the better way is called the Palatini method. And the basic idea of the Palatini method is that instead of taking this equation for granted, you start by forgetting this equation, and you treat gamma and G as two a priori independent fields. And you're going to vary the action with respect to this guy, set that equal to zero. And then you're also going to vary the action with respect to this guy and set that equal to zero. So now here, I go through this very briefly in the notes, but I'm just going to tell you here that the idea is that when you vary with respect to G, but treating this as an independent variable, it does not vary. So in other words, the idea is you vary the metric, but since this is independent, this doesn't vary when this varies. That turns out to simplify the variation with respect to this guy a great deal. So I'm about to do that. I'm about to show you more explicitly what happens then. But I'm just going to tell you what happens when you vary this guy, which is that when you vary this guy, what you get back is the equation of motion, is the resulting equation of motion. So you vary this guy, and you set the resulting variation in the action to zero, you find that the Euler-Lagrange equations which come out of that variation are this formula. You get back this formula. Okay, so it's just a clever trick. This is Palatini's trick. You forget this guy, you treat it as an independent variable to be varied. When you vary it, you get back the formula that you wanted at the beginning, but the other variation with respect to G that leads to the Einstein equations becomes much easier. So that's the thing that I'm going to show you now. I think there's just enough time. Okay. So we want to vary this thing with respect to G. So the first step is to rewrite it like so now, R only depends on gamma. So when we vary the metric, R does not vary. Okay. So what is going to vary in this action? The only things that are going to vary are the things that depend on the metric. So there will be the metric will appear in here. We'll see more explicitly how it does in later. But for now, so this thing in general will depend on the metric. And then the other things, that the other places where the metric appears are here and here. So before performing the variation, we just need two facts. So one is, if I vary the metric a little bit, what variation does that induce in the inverse metric? So what if I given a variation of this, what is the corresponding variation of this, or vice versa? So that you can just, you know, since the inverse metric is always by definition the inverse of the metric, I can vary both sides of this equation. It must remain true even as I vary it. So when I vary both sides, I get this. Okay, so this is the relationship that we'll need between these two guys. Or so, in other words, let me. So, you know. So this is the relationship. Then the other thing is, what is the G? Did I say this? G is the determinant of the matrix G mu nu. Sorry, I forgot to say that. So if you vary a matrix by a little bit to first order, what is the variation in the determinant? So there is a formula from this is a general thing for linear algebra. It has nothing to do with metrics. And the formula for this is called the Jacobi identity. You may or may not remember this. It is, what is it? And so the probably the easiest way to derive this, if you want, is to appeal to another formula, which you probably do remember. And this one is sort of, it's more clear how you check this one. You diagonalize both sides of this formula. But so you probably remember this formula that, oh, actually, I always need to remember. I always need to work out again. I'm going to do this wrong. So determinant of a matrix A is what? It's like trace of log, no.
Exponential trace log.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Okay, so from this expression, assuming A is invertible, you can, by differentiating this expression, by varying both sides of this expression, you'll see that you can derive this formula. I'm just going to now just invoke this formula, which again goes under the name of the Jacobi identity or the Jacobi formula, something. Okay, so those are the two bits we need. So now when we vary, yikes. When we vary here. Well, I don't want to run over. Are they checking the rest?
5 minutes.
Okay. So if this is the variation of the metric, then the variation of the square root of minus g is, well, 1/2 times minus g to the minus 1/2 times minus the variation of g. But the variation of g is this thing, so that all becomes 1/2 square root of minus g alpha beta delta g alpha beta. But then using this formula, I'm going to, you know, using this formula, I can pull these two indices down and push these two indices up if I add an overall minus sign. Okay? Did I also make an... Okay, I think that's right. Okay, so delta S is... That's supposed to be a delta of square root of minus g. That's what I thought. I might have lost a minus sign. So what?
The minus sign before, it cancels that minus sign.
Okay.
So you don't need
I seem to remember that's right, so I hope you're right. Okay, anyway, so that I think you're probably right, although I don't. Okay. So we're varying this guy, so we get one term that comes from the variation of this thing, and then so that's just multiplied by everything that's in square brackets here. And then, in addition to that, we get let's call these giant square brackets. And then, in addition to that, we get a term that is times the variation of this thing. And then another term, which is just the partial derivative of L with respect to the inverse metric times the variation in the inverse metric. So here I'm using the fact that this Lagrangian is going to, in general, depend on the metric, but not on derivatives of the metric. So as long as it only depends algebraically on the metric and not on derivatives of the metric, then the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric is just the partial derivative with respect to the metric times the variation. So now if you just plug in our formula that we derived over here, if you plug in this formula and then just collect, write this expression as d4x. You pull out a factor of square root of minus g from every term, and you pull out a variation of the inverse metric from every term. Then the thing that you're left with is the thing that has to vanish, and that is just the Einstein equation. So what you'll end up with here is like r mu nu minus 1/2 r g mu nu. So that's an exercise that is definitely worth going through. We've almost done all of the algebra here, but you should really definitely go through and just check for yourself that the resulting thing you get if you set the remaining bit in curly brackets that you've collected to zero, and then pull all the curvature and geometrical terms over to one side, pull all the terms that depend on L sub m, the matter Lagrangian, to the other side, and the resulting thing that you end up with is this famous formula, the Einstein equations. Where we've defined to get things to look this way, we've had to define this thing called the Einstein tensor, which you will see from your algebra is the Ricci tensor minus 1/2 the metric times the Ricci scalar. And this thing, we've also defined the stress energy tensor, which you'll see from your algebra is, I'm going to get this wrong. It's in the notes. Do you guys? Okay, yeah, I have the notes. I always mix up my twos here. So T mu nu you'll find is G mu nu times whatever the matter Lagrangian was minus 2 times the partial derivative of the matter Lagrangian with respect to G mu nu. And so then in the notes, I just give a simple example just to make sure you know what you're doing with this formula. I give a simple example, which is suppose that the matter Lagrangian is the Lagrangian for a single scalar field. So that has a Lagrangian that looks like. So this is the kinetic term for the Lagrangian, and this is the potential term for the Lagrangian for the scalar field. Anyway, so to make sure you know what you're doing with this formula, just work out this simple example. Just check that when you apply this formula to this Lagrangian, that you get the sort of final, the stress energy tensor for the scalar field, which is the final, I think, expression in my notes, or nearly the final expression before Yang-Mills theory, which we didn't get to. As I said before, if you have time, I think it is strongly worth your while to try to read through the Yang-Mills section at the end of these first lecture notes and try to understand to some degree what the relationship is between the two theories. So the gauge field in Yang-Mills theory is playing a role very much, very close to the connection to the Christoffel symbol in general relativity, and the field strength defined from the Yang-Mills field is essentially the same thing as is playing a very closely analogous role to the curvature tensor, the Riemann curvature tensor. So the gauge transformations U are playing a very closely analogous role to the coordinate transformations in general relativity. Okay, so this. I think for the purposes of getting on with things, I'm not going to cover that in the next lecture. In the next lecture, which is again on Wednesday, I'll be going directly to a survey of the most important metrics. Okay. Thanks.